Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The smartphone, that little computer in our hand, has brought a sea of changes to how we interact, radically changing society, relationships. Now, new research says it significantly affects the way our brain works, even when we're not using it. Could be in the next room or turned off entirely, still impairing our cognitive functions, hurting our intellectual function. This hour, On Point, smartphones and our brains. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you feel like your smartphone is draining your brain power? Beyond the phantom ring, does your phone call to you even when you're not using it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. Do we want those phones around? Do we count on them? Are we anxious when they're not there? Here's an NBC News report from January. Reporter Erica Edwards outlining the dependency many people experience on their smartphones.
The smartphone has become an extension of ourselves. In fact, a new study of iPhone users from the University of Missouri found anxiety, heart rate, and blood pressure all increased when people were not able to answer their mobile devices.
Okay, we know that. And here's former Google product manager Tristan Harris telling CBS's 60 Minutes over the summer that tech companies, you know, are designing the phones on purpose to make sure we're checking them constantly. He compares them to a little slot machine.
Every time I check my phone, I'm playing the slot machine to see what did I get. This is one way to hijack people's minds and create a habit. What you do is you make it so when someone pulls a lever, sometimes they get a reward, an exciting reward. And it turns out that this design technique can be embedded inside of all these products.
Well, okay, maybe even that's okay. But what if it's making us somehow less smart? Joining me now from Boulder, Colorado, is Nicholas Carr. He writes about technology and culture. His recent Wall Street Journal piece is headlined, How Smartphones Hijack Our Minds. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Carr, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Are we talking about maybe what's the effect we're talking about on brains, minds, thinking?
Well, there's two kind of effects. One that we already knew of, which is that our phone distracts us when we're using it or when it's buzzing or beeping. So if we're trying to do something else and you have your phone around and it's kind of tugging at your sleeve, yeah, then that's a distraction. We know distractions impede performance, impede thinking. But the newer research shows something much deeper, which is that even when we're not using the phone and it's not making any noise, even when it's turned off but it's near us, still some part of our attention, some significant part of our attention and our brain power is devoted to the phone. It's become so wrapped up in our lives and in our thoughts that even when we're not using it, we're thinking about using it, and that drains away some of our capacity for thinking that we would otherwise devote to, you know, whatever task is in front of us.
I mean, there might be all kinds of things that I'm thinking about at the edges of my mind while I'm going about some task or even thinking something through. Is this a big deal? I might be thinking about lunch. I might be thinking about, you know, Susie. I don't know. Is this a big deal?
I think it is a big deal because we've always known that our mind is attracted to objects around us that have what psychologists refer to as salience, that are, you know, changing or might give us some new information or something. But excuse me, what's different here is that we've never had a personal technology, a media technology that incorporates so many functions, so much information, incorporates all the conversations our friends are having. Mm-hmm. So it seems to have a particularly large pull on our minds that is very much tied up in its usefulness and its attractiveness to us. It's almost, you know, a classic example of this is the example of a newborn baby. If you're a parent of a baby and the baby is in the room with you, even if the baby's sleeping soundly, a lot of your mind is devoted to even subconsciously to monitoring the child and suppressing the desire to go over and look at the child.
How's it doing? What's it doing? Should I pick it up? Can I pick it up?
the smartphone mm-hmm. seems to have that kind of power on us. It's always beckoning to us. And so even just suppressing the desire to check it takes up some of our mental capacity.
You know, Nick, this is counterintuitive in many ways. I mean, that smartphone is just packed with information. We've got search engines in there that where you can go to almost anything, find out almost anything. It would seem as though this should be a supplement to our mental, our even our intellectual capacity.
I think what we're learning is that it can be both a supplement, a very valuable supplement when we're using it for that purpose. But it also at the same time can detract from our attentiveness, can waylay our thinking. And what we're learning, and it's through these studies, other studies about memory and how we socialize and stuff, is that our assumption when we started using the internet, using social media, that having access, merely having access to more information would make us smarter – that doesn't seem to be true. That's too simple. It's at least as important as the access we get is how the information is delivered to us. And it's through that phenomenon that the smartphone in particular seems to, as some researchers say, cause a brain drain.
Nick Carr, walk through some of this research with us, because I can imagine people listening and, people are really attached to their phones. I can imagine people who feel empowered by them, who feel informed by them and maybe skeptical, or even if intuitively they wonder if you might be right, they still want to hear the proof points. Take us through the studies that you're citing here.
Okay. So there, as I said, there's kind of two phenomena going on here. One is the distraction phenomenon. In there have been several studies that show, and you mentioned one going into the segment, that if you're using your phone or your phone buzzes at you and stuff, it's a distraction. We know distractions reduce our ability to focus and complete tasks, particularly difficult ones. But now there's research, and it started with I think the first study came out of the University of Southern Maine in, I believe, 2014. Mm-hmm. And it showed that even if a person isn't using their phone, it's just sitting there on their desk, for instance, it seems to impede their performance on a difficult task. And then the really compelling study, I think, came out in April of this year. It was done by a team of four psychologists led by a guy named Adrian Ward at the University of Texas at Austin. They got a large number of students at the University of California at San Diego, where two other researchers were located, more than 500 participants. And they had them take two different tests of their intelligence. Okay. And these are fundamental kind of standard tests, one that measures your available cognitive capacity, which means, how much of your brain power can you devote to a particular task or a particular train of thought. And the other was a test of fluid intelligence, which is very much, how well we're able to think, how well we're able to make sense of new phenomena and do problems that we've never seen before. So these are fundamental tests of intelligence. They had these people, they divided these people randomly into three sets. One set had their phone in front of them, okay, turned off or turned to silent on their desk while they were doing these tests. The other had their phone on them in their pocket or in their handbag. And then the third group had their phones in a different room, were required to put their phones in a different mm-hmm. room. And what you saw from the results of the test is that the people who had their phones on their desk did far worse on these tests of basic intelligence than did the people who had their phones in a different room, and the people who had their phones with them but not in sight did somewhere in between. And so as the researcher said, there seems to be this linear relationship between how close your phone is to you and how much attention and how much cognitive capacity you can devote to whatever you're working on.
That's just wild. I wonder if people are buying it. We want to really dig in on this. We've got one of the researchers who was on that very study who will join us in a moment. We've got callers for you already, Nick. You're there in Boulder, Colorado, and Katie is calling from Missouri, Columbia, Missouri. Katie, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Nick Carr.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I work in a research lab, and I actually use my phone a lot to look up a procedure or check the properties of a chemical I might be working with.
Yeah.
And I also, at the same time, listen to music while I'm in lab, which for me personally helps me stay focused on the task at hand. And like having heard this study several times, I am also curious about the fact that as a scientist, I'm quite aware of the error that humans can produce just on their own. And I'm wondering if this study, if the results could maybe have something to do with the fact that people with their cell phone might be more prone to check themselves. For example, if they're doing arithmetic, they might be more more likely to check their math instead of just relying on their mental math abilities.
You mean so they'd be slowed down in that way?
Potentially slowed down, but I always kind of have to check myself and make sure that I am not, you know, making a small mistake or, excuse me, forgetting a step of the procedure I'm trying to do. And so I think I'm wondering if part of the results of this study could be because of someone wanting to check themselves and make sure that, you know, what they thought the answer was actually correct. Since we do have access to this wide range of information with our cell phones, they can serve such a variety of purposes.
Katie, let me ask you, though, Katie, you're a scientist, and here's a study done in San Diego. We're going to talk with one of the people who did it but after the break. But, you know, I get it. It feels like it helps you. But here's a scientific study done saying, you know what, you do this over a big number of people, and they do more poorly when it's around. You're not buying it? Do you think you're exempt from what they found in general?
I don't think I'm exempt. I'm curious as to their specific protocol of their test. For example, is it more of a like arithmetic style test, or is it something that is more subjective?
Okay, we're going to pick that up right after a break here. Katie, in the research lab in Columbia, Missouri, we're really happy that you called in. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom. Just a quick message before we get back to the show. I'm inviting you to stick around at the end of this podcast for an excerpt from another NPR show, Only a Game. Here's why. This weekend, Only a Game is examining power and corruption at the NCAA after the FBI arrested 10 people, including 4 college basketball coaches, for allegedly accepting bribes. College players and their families are vulnerable. Listen for a sneak preview of Only a Game's episode, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, at the end of our show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about our smartphones and our brains, our intelligence. Research now saying smartphones can distract us and more, to the point of, I don't know about stupidity, but to the point that they really impinge on our intellectual capacity, our mental capacity. Nick Carr has been writing about this for the Wall Street Journal. You can link to his story at our website, onpointradio.org. And it's very thorough, very compelling roundup of all the research that's been done on this front. You can join us in this hour as well. Does all that data in your hand make you smarter, more thoughtful? Are you sure? And when maybe Siri is doing all the work, or Alexa, what's happening to your brain cells, your mind, when that phone is not in your hand? Is it always on your mind, distracting, maybe diluting your thinking? Nick Carr is with us from Boulder, Colorado. And Nick, it's great to have you there. Kristen Duke joins us right now as well from New York. She's a PhD candidate at the Rady School of Management, the University of California, San Diego. She's been studying the way smartphones and the internet affect our thoughts and judgment. She's co-author of the study that Nick was talking about, published in April in the Journal of the Association of Consumer Research about smartphones and cognitive capacity. Kristen Duke in New York, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you heard our caller, Katie, in Columbia, Missouri, wanting to know, scientist there doing research, likes her cell phone, likes to have it near at hand to look up, you know, chemical properties or have music going on, and not exactly wanting to buy this, but interested in exactly what you measured and how. Can you describe your study to us that found and its findings?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I think Katie brings up a good point, which is essentially that when people can use their phone to assist them with completing tasks, oftentimes they are really helpful, right? We can outsource our complicated calculations. We can use the internet to find information. But what we were interested in studying is essentially what is the effect of having the phone merely nearby when you're not interacting with it at all. So just having the phone, you know, out on the desk in front of you, perhaps face down so you can't see anything happening on the screen, or even turned off completely so there's no possibility of interaction. And we wanted to know, what does that do to people's cognitive capacity?
So that was you measured three ways, right? It's on the table with you, but you're not looking at it.
Right. Yeah. So
another way in your pocket, and another way in another room.
Yes, yes. So we had three different conditions, and we ran the same study generally two times. So one time, the three conditions were either having the phone out on the desk face down and on silent, not vibrate or anything, so you can't see anything happening on the phone. In another condition, the phone was just wherever people carry it naturally, so in their bag or in their pocket.
Out of sight.
Then the final, yes, exactly, out of sight but nearby. And then the final case was when the phone was placed in a separate room entirely. So it's far away, totally out of sight, not salient.
And Nick has summarized this, but describe the tests that you then put to people with their phone in these different circumstances.
Yeah, so we had two tests. The main test was a measure of working memory capacity. So this idea of how much cognitive resources people have at a given time to use to problem solve and perform different tasks. And then the other was a measure of fluid intelligence, which is another measure of people's ability to solve novel problems. And we did have a third measure, which was designed to assess whether people are able to keep their attention on the actual screen and keep their attention on the task at hand. And so we find, essentially, people are still looking at the screen, so they're still completing the task on the computer when their phone is nearby. So it's not that they're looking away at the phone and that's detracting from their ability. But just having the phone nearby did occupy some of their cognitive capacity, so it took away from those mental resources in those two other tasks.
And how clear were the distinctions in performance, whether it was on the desk with you, stored away, or in another room?
Yeah, so they were measurable, significant differences, not huge differences, right? So we have a lot of variation within individuals, but even beyond that, variation across students, we were still able to observe a significant difference on these measures as based on where the phone was placed.
Nick Carr, you've looked at this study. Would you say that this applies to everybody, or are some, you know, maybe some people have the capacity to have the phone nearby and still use all their brains, and some of us are vulnerable to complete obsession with it that shuts down our capacity?
Well, one of the other things that this study showed is that the more dependent people were on their phone, the more they used it all the time, the bigger the negative effect it had. So I do think that there are going to be variations with people. Some of those might just be natural variations with how different people think, but some of it is with how wrapped up you are with your phone in general in your everyday life. And the more you're dependent on it, the more you're thinking about it as a result, and the more of a penalty you have with your thinking.
Let's go to Melanie in Venice, Florida, listening as we talk today about cell phones and our mental capacity. Melanie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm a school teacher, and I'm actually an artist and an art teacher, and I have been for the past 25 years. And although I'm not a scientist, I do have my master's degree in the science of education. So I've been very interested in following the research and studies that are being done on electronics and children and the rewiring of the brain and what happens with their dopamine and serotonin levels when they're on these devices and then they're taken away. I've actually seen children have like withdrawal symptoms and meltdowns. But within the art room, I can tell you that I have noticed a very significant decline in a child's ability to problem solve. And I do see that when they're on the computer, they're used to getting answers that are already sort of pre-generated, sort of like the toys that they play with aren't building blocks and, you know, manipulative toys. They're sort of, you push a button and you push another button and you get an answer. And, you know, it's not like they're really cognitively thinking about anything. So in the artistic making process or the creative making process, you know, it's a process of problem solving. And there's been an enormous decline in that as well as in fine motor skills. And I don't know, you're going to be a surgeon or a, you know, somebody building bridges, you certainly need to have the capacity to problem solve and have both fine motor skills as well. So,
Melanie, let us pick that up if you'd be kind enough. And I'm really happy for your call from Venice there. If I may, Kristen Nicholas, Melanie, thank you. Let's get one more call here. Another teacher, I think, Cheryl in Savannah, Georgia. Cheryl, you're on.
Hi, Tom. As a teacher, my school system decided that it would be cheaper for them to let the students bring their own phones to school instead of buying computers for them, okay, even though Chromebooks are very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. So the children have their phones out all the time. They won't put them away. As a high school teacher, you can't really make them put them away. And I've had students that will refuse to put their phone away to take tests and take a zero instead of taking a test.
You mean because they're so kind of addicted to its presence?
That's right. They feel like it's an extension of their body. And if you take it away from them, you are violating their personhood or something. It is, it's like they can't handle it. They get visibly upset. And I've had one child, I took his phone away, and he broke my door handle trying to get it back.
Wow, that's yeah, a connection. Cheryl in Savannah, thank you for your call. Nick Card, take these first two calls from teachers who are paying a lot of attention to the way young minds work. Can you put them in the context of the studies you've been looking at, Nick?
Yes, because there are also studies, similar studies to the one we talked about, that are being conducted in schools, usually colleges. And for instance, there was another study that came out this year. It was done at the University of Arkansas at the Monticello campus, mm-hmm, where the researchers took 160 students that were in a lecture class, divided them again into different categories. Some didn't bring their phones into class. Some had their phones with them but didn't use them, and others had their phones with them and used them. They listened to a lecture, and then they took a test, an examination on the material that was presented, and you saw very similar results, that the people who didn't have their phone with them at all scored, in fact, a full letter grade higher on the exam than did the people who had their phone. And it didn't really matter if the people who had their phone used it or just kept it in their pocket. They all scored pretty much equally poorly. So here we see, you know, in a real world, real classroom situation, a very similar effect, that the mere presence of your phone seems to get in the way not only of your thinking but of your learning.
Kristen, how would you explain that? I mean, maybe that's more than your research looks at. You got the result. People did less well when the phone was nearer. But have you studied or speculated about why that might be?
Yeah, so the way we think about it is, you know, imagine you and I are at a bar, Tom, and mm-hmm, we're talking, okay, and it's loud in the background. Lots of other people are talking around us, mm-hmm, but I'm focusing on you. I'm not listening to any of their conversations.
Okay.
But if in the course of their conversation somebody says, Kristen, I hear it, right? They say my name and I automatically attend to it.
Yeah.
So I wasn't listening to their conversation. I wasn't even aware of what was going on, but something within me was sort of automatically attending to what's going on, looking for my name.
Yeah, but hang on a second, because these phones in your study, they're not chirping.
Yeah.
They're not giving little Twitter beeps or whatever.
Right, yeah. We don't think it's a conscious process. It's not something like, oh, I'm constantly monitoring to see if I'm actually getting notifications. I think it's deeper than that, sort of this automatic attentional process deep within our brain that we're not necessarily controlling. And so within our minds, there's something just sort of listening to our phone because we've come to rely on it so much. And as the caller said, it's sort of like an extension of ourselves now.
Nick, that's a very interesting kind of picture that Kristen paints. How do you put it from looking at all these studies about why this might be the case, that the mere presence of a cell phone would cut into our mental performance?
Well, as Kristen indicated, I think this is a very deep, primordial process. Our minds are monitoring systems. And this probably helped our ancestors survive when they lived in the wild. You wanted to kind of devote some of your attention and some of your mind's capacity to the environment and what was going
on. Sure. Do I hear
it?
A roar, a growl, a snapping
right.
twig?
And with this, with a smartphone, it incorporates so much possibly interesting information. You know, everything our friends are sharing on Snapchat or Instagram or whatever, the news, headlines, photos, and it's all compressed into this one little rectangle. And so when you bring it in and it's around you, without your conscious awareness, a lot of your mind is devoted to either thinking about what might be going on inside that phone or actually suppressing your desire to go over and grab it and check it because there is all this stuff. And all of those things drain away, pull away some of our mental capacity that we could be and often should be devoting to hard thinking, hard problem solving, learning, memory, and so forth.
Mercedes is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Mercedes, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess my question or comment is in regards to how different these cell phones are from other distractors in our lives. I guess I could say more about that if you want. But
You mean well, how is it different from, a fire engine or a TV on in the background or that sort of thing?
Well, sure. Yeah, definitely something like that. Or say, so you have these cell phones that are, you know, they're turned off, but they're in your vicinity, in your range of sight, and then you have them put away or in another room entirely. If you were to have a child in the room that wasn't crying or upset, but just calm, there versus in another room, I mean, I understand that these pieces of technology are kind of designed in order to have us pay attention to them, but so are many other stimuli that are in our environments. I mean, how can we really... Is this a measure of saying the phone is a distractor in and of itself, or that we're just easily distractible in general?
Yeah, we got it, Kristen. What about it? How's the cell phone different from a child in the room or a chessboard or a TV, even if it's not on?
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And so some of what Nick mentioned was that our effects varied as a function of how dependent people are on their phones, which I think suggests that smartphones are special in the sense that some people rely on them so much that they've become a part of themselves. And there are very few other things in the world that have become so a part of ourselves. But I did like what the caller said about a child in the room, right? Of course, if it's your child, you're going to be a lot more attentive to that child. That's going to distract you a lot more, perhaps, than another child in the room. But what was interesting about this work was that this is something that people can control, right? I can control where I put my smartphone in many situations. Mm-hmm. And so if I can recognize this distractor and I can remove it from my environment and that can improve my performance, that's something we thought would be worth knowing.
Of course, the thing is that we tend not to do that because it's so darn
right.
captivating to have around. Here's a little sound from Larry Rosen, a psychologist at California State Dominguez Hills. Studied the psychological impact of technology and told 60 Minutes recently that when you put your phone down, your brain signals your body to produce a hormone called cortisol, which triggers a fight-or-flight response to danger. Talk about impinging on thinking. Here's Larry Rosen.
The typical person checks their phone every 15 minutes or less, and half of the time they check their phone, there's no alert, no notification. It's coming from inside their head telling them, gee, I haven't checked in Facebook in a while. I haven't checked on this Twitter feed for a while. I wonder if somebody commented on my Instagram post. That then generates cortisol, and it starts to make you anxious. And eventually your goal is to get rid of that anxiety, so you check in.
You check in on your phone every 15 minutes or less. Nick, a lot of people I know, it looks like every 15 seconds or less they're checking that phone. You're talking about, you write about a gullibility crisis. You say this may go to a bigger picture, Nick, of how we look at the world.
I think it does. And it's this research and also research into how our reliance on smartphones and the internet seems to make us less likely to remember facts and experience that we've had. And if you look at across all of this research, I think it indicates that, you know, when our smartphones are around, our reasoning takes a hit, our recall takes a hit. And, you know, we've been seeing, you know, well-publicized problems with people believing particularly stuff that's circulated through social media that is either a lie or a half-truth or misinformation. And I do think, and I don't mean to suggest this is the only cause of that, but if your reasoning and your recall and your ability to think conceptually and critically and solve problems are depressed by the fact that your phone is around and you're dependent on it, I do think that that probably is a contributing factor to you know, what we might call a gullibility crisis in society.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our smartphones and our brains, our intelligence. Research now saying smartphones can distract us to the point of some degree of stupidity. Nick Carr's been writing about it for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Kristen Duke has been on a team doing central research on this recently. She's at the Rady School of Management, the University of California, San Diego, with us today. You can join us as well. Do you buy it? Is there a way to get the advantages but not the downside here? And what are we supposed to do with this information? Tell your boss you're not going to carry a phone? You can't be reached? You're resting your brain, your mental capacity? I mean, you've got some people who are feeling this and acting on it, trying to take some kind of measures, maybe compromise measures, to keep from being so distracted here. This is a little tape from James Hamblin, a doctor, senior editor at The Atlantic, who has intentionally switched the color scheme on his iPhone to grayscale. Gray. He explained why in his video series, If Our Bodies Could Talk.
So a lot of people look at my phone and they think, oh, it's broken, but I actually have it purposefully in black and white, and it's just a little mind hack, I guess. There's a reason that every notification on your phone is red. That is a color that stimulates excitement in the brain. Las Vegas has known this forever. There are bright red flashing neon lights everywhere trying to get your attention. You're constantly stimulated. That's why people just love Vegas. They go crazy.
Can't get enough of it. People responding here on Facebook, Nick, Kristen, Moonbird says, the smartphone phenomenon has daily effects, vital brain tasks, numbers, dates, and facts. We have decentralized our intelligence. It's interesting, you've got some technologists talking about further decentralizing our intelligence. Elon Musk among them, Tesla and SpaceX CEO, kind of big thinker, big mover and shaker. Earlier this year, he was telling the World Government Summit in Dubai that over time, humans will need to evolve to the point of communicating directly with machines, computers, or risk irrelevance in an age of artificial intelligence. Let's listen. Elon Musk.
To some degree, we are already a cyborg. You can ask a question and instantly get an answer from Google. Over time, I think we'll probably see a closer merger of biological intelligence and digital intelligence. And it's mostly about the bandwidth, the speed of the connection between your brain and your digital, the digital extension of yourself.
The digital extension of yourself. Today, you might think of that as your smartphone, but Elon Musk is thinking about something more integrated. He's talking about a project called Neuralink, which sort of will merge humans beyond that phone in your hand, but maybe deeper. I don't know, a chip in the back of your head. I don't know, with computer power. Here's another little bit of his commentary about the reason why. He says, do this or humans may become irrelevant.
A computer can communicate at a trillion bits per second, but your thumb can maybe do, I don't know, 10 bits per second or 100 if you're being generous. So some high bandwidth interface to the brain, I think, will be something that helps achieve a symbiosis and between human and machine intelligence, and maybe solves the control problem and the usefulness problem.
The usefulness problem, as in usefulness of Homo sapiens. That's you and me. Antonio Regalado from the MIT Technology Review joins us in just a moment. But Nick, I want to put that to you. I mean, if you're looking at these studies, looking at smartphones in our hand, what about the whole notion of integrating computer power into our very thinking process, Nick? Does that look like we end up net better off? Or somehow we atrophy our core, you know, some would say God-given computer power, our brains?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I think what Musk is talking about is still very much in the realm of speculative science fiction, because we don't he's implying that we'll be able to, kind of independent of language, pre-verbal thinking, create some kind of link with our brain. The problem is we don't know how our neurons, how our brain gives rise to specific thoughts. So doing that is still way, way, way beyond even our understanding of how the brain works.
Okay, we'll ask Antonio about that. He's been thinking along these same lines. But imagine, I mean, at some point, it's hard to imagine that we won't have some kind of link up. It may be further away than he says. He's talking about, I don't know, a decade from now or something. Well, let's go right to Antonio. Antonio Regalado joins us. He's biomedicine reporter for the MIT Technology Review. He's looked a lot at brain implant technology and its promise or, you know, its distance from us right now. Antonio, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here, Tom.
So we're talking about smartphones in the hand and distractions to thinking, maybe a diminishment of our mental capacity. Let's just start there before we get inside our brain maybe someday. Nick's reporting on all these studies. Kristen Duke has done one of them, saying this looks like it cuts back on our mental capacity. Does that make intuitive sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, I have direct experience of that. Every day I go home to an 8-year-old daughter and both her parents are, you know, slot machine addicts.
In your smartphone.
Exactly. And, you know, it's disturbing to think about and it causes strife in my home.
Pay attention to the child, not just that gizmo in your hand.
Exactly. Imagine you saw someone in a casino surrounded by their children pulling at their skirts. You'd say that's a very bad parent. And yet, in my own house, it happens with a smartphone.
Okay. So we got the guilty parenting part. That's not a small thing. We could do a whole show just on that. I totally get it. I see it all the time. But do you buy that your mental capacity may be impaired by your and many other people's allegiance to that smartphone?
I'm glad to see that there's research going on. I mean, I feel greatly enhanced by the smartphone. In my work as a journalist, you know, I'm finding things out. I'm communicating with people, linking up with people with shared interests all the time, instantaneously. Just outside the studio, you guys tweeted that the show was on. I retweeted it to my followers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, our abilities are enhanced in obvious ways. It's less clear you know, what the detrimental aspects are. My attention is certainly divided.
We're going to look ahead at brain implants as well, but Antonio, stand by for a second. Mike in Cincinnati is calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share an experience and have them comment on it. But I'm a 51-year-old guy, and I noticed in third grade that television was addictive. So I stopped watching television in fourth grade.
Okay.
And eventually, when I got a smartphone, I noticed I became addicted to it. And about 3 years ago, I really couldn't take it anymore. But I noticed the same issues that they've been talking about. Like, I do things like in the car, I'd turn it off so that I wouldn't use it. But my mind would constantly be drawn to it, and I'd eventually turn it back on. So eventually, I got rid of it 3 years ago. And I went through physical withdrawal for about 3 or 4 weeks. So, for example, I'd find myself driving, and I'd actually step on the gas so I could get home faster to get to Facebook and email, you know. But after what I found was after 3 or 4 weeks, that feeling of withdrawal passed. And I literally, there hasn't been a single time I've missed not having a smartphone except if I'm traveling for work and I need
So you miss it, or you did miss it. But what about the notion, or more than that, the studies that say it diminishes your mental capacity? Do you buy that, Mike?
And I did find that. The way I thought about it back then was that the phone owned a certain portion or percentage of my mind and my consciousness constantly. And so I found, for example, I'm a very good writer, and I found my ability to write diminished.
Mike, we got it in Cincinnati. Thank you very much. Tim in Richmond, Virginia. Tim, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call on what I think is a very important subject. I am 37. I have been in the cell phone industry in a retail environment for the past 14 years. I carry two phones, and I will be
you're really messed up, Tim.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll be the first to admit that. And just as you pointed out, a smoker who will, as a past smoker, I can attest to this.
Okay.
As somebody who will smoke out of boredom, and you know.
Yeah.
Form those neural pathways that cause that habit, just like any other habit. The smartphone definitely does the exact same thing. If I find myself idle, just wondering what to do for half a second, I'll definitely pick up a phone. And the problem is there, you get sucked in. A cigarette lasts a minute and a half in a YouTube video. Right. You know, you can watch forever.
YouTube lasts forever,
Right. But my point is to talk about the original study. And there's something that sticks out as somebody who has helped all demographics of customers for the past 14 years.
Wait, what business are you in, Tim?
I work in a cell phone store.
Oh, you sell cell phones. So you're a pusher. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So I'm the one peddling.
Okay.
And trying to help people cope with this, honestly. But seeing, listening to that study and seeing such a strong correlation in that study indicates to me that probably one demographic or similar demographics were targeted. Because if I look at a 15-year-old versus a 30-year-old versus a 45 or a 60-year-old, those phones are assigned a much different value to people who have different demographics.
What, younger users are more deeply enmeshed with their phone? Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. And the phone is a tool. It's a piece of hardware. It's not the tool itself. It's the applications that people decide to use.
Yeah, Tim, we got it. Our time is ticking. I really appreciate your call from a peddler himself of cell phones, and we got it. Thank you. Antonio, all right, take on the Elon Musk vision here. I just want to spend a minute with it because, you know, we're told by big technologists, he's big, that, you know, we're talking about somehow integrating computers in our minds. Now, if a cell phone in your hand has a net effect of diminishing your mental capacity, what about, are we going to one day have chips shoved in the back of our, you know, head with, I don't know, all the periodic table and the geography of the world and everything on them that we're going to be referencing somehow seamlessly? And then what happens to our brains? Or is that, do you think that's just sci-fi, forget about it?
Well, I mean, that seems to be what Musk has proposed with his company, Neuralink. I mean, you get on the bus, you go outdoors, people are looking at their phones, they have the Apple earbuds in their ears. You know, it's not just your eyes, it's your ears as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ultimate extrapolation would be an implant in your brain.
Is that doable?
Well, it is. I mean, there's certainly demonstrations whereby electrodes are put in the brains of animals or humans, and they can be used to control computers. A cursor on a computer screen, even a robotic arm. There's cases of paralyzed patients.
Yep.
They can fairly dexterously, in some cases, pick up and move objects. To Nick Carr's point, though, it's not the thought exactly, you know, I want to move this. They read the motor neurons, where scientists have kind of figured out if they measure the neurons, the firing rate of each neuron has some information about your intended, say, arm movement. So they can grab that information and use it to move a cursor.
Move the mechanical arm or?
Or the arm. So then the question becomes, well, could you, as Mark Zuckerberg has said at Facebook, you know, he wants to get people to text from their brains. So could you do that?
Think a text. And out it goes. We'll look at that. We're talking about little computer smartphones and maybe beyond, maybe inside our brains. I mean, you've already got or have had, and I'm sure we'll have more of a Google Glass where it's not just in your hand, but it's right up in front of your eyes. Texting, I guess it would pick up on words. But this idea of a supplemental intelligence or data set being somehow plugged in.
Right.
Is that something that sounds fanciful or one day possible?
Well, we could talk about if it's possible and sort of what are the motivations. The motivations in Mark Zuckerberg's case, he said it would be convenient to be able to post to Facebook while you're talking to somebody.
Wouldn't that be great? You'd be on Facebook all the time. Yeah. For me, the motivation would be you don't have to study math. We just plug it in the back of your head and you've got it.
Right. So there's kind of two ways to do it. In terms of getting the information out to control the external world, there have been demonstrations
already.
Of that.
We're there.
It's not yet at the point of a chip to put in your brain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's electrodes in a person's brain with a cable coming out, going to a giant rack of computers.
They're tapping off your own brain, though, to do it.
They're tapping the information in the person's brain to move a robotic arm.
But what about an integrated equivalent of the smartphone that's now in our hand? You don't have to hold it anymore. It's somehow more closely enmeshed with your mind.
As Nick Carr said, that is science fiction.
Okay.
It may not be forever because nobody's really tried. So here we have Elon Musk, who is the CEO of Tesla, who is the CEO of SpaceX.
Yeah.
He specializes in these big, complex projects that each also have this sort of bigger social goal.
Mm-hmm.
With the cars, it's stop global warming, with the rockets, get to a backup planet Mars, and with Neuralink, it is to keep up with artificial intelligence.
Yeah, stay relevant.
They stay relevant. They think the solution is we need an interface between the brain and the computer that operates, as Musk said, at a much higher bit rate, a higher rate of communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
So although it is absurd what he's claiming to do, it seems silly. It's malarkey. On the other hand, no one of his stature has ever put $100 million into it. So yeah. As a reporter, I have to keep an open mind. I'm kind of following it. You know, maybe he can do it.
Nikar, riff on that. Where our minds go over time if we become even closer than the smartphone in our hand.
I mean, leaving aside the question of how possible this is, I think it gives us insight into how Silicon Valley in the tech industry thinks about human beings in their brains. They think of our brains as being kind of computers. And if we can connect them to other computers, all the better. And we can just, you know, be part of a network. And what they don't seem to understand is that there is something called understanding. There is something called knowledge. There is something called conceptual thinking that we really have to struggle with information and remember it and connect it with other things. And that is actually what makes us valuable as thinkers, as creative people, and underpins our insight. And this is totally lost in this vision of our brains as plugged into computers. And I think it also reflects how Facebook and Google and Apple and all these companies devise their smartphones and devise their apps. It's really about displacing understanding and knowledge so we can just take in little bits of information all the quicker.
Kristen, we've just got half a minute. With the smartphone in our hand, then, by your research, are we already somehow backseating our natural mental capacity, throwing it in the backseat in favor of the computer?
I think there are some cases where the smartphone is super critical and helpful to us in improving our lives, staying constantly communicative. But I think there are some costs that are worth acknowledging.
This has been a great heads up. And Nick Carr, you got us thinking about it in the first place. Nicholas Carr. You see his work all over the place, but the latest in the Wall Street Journal, you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us today from Boulder, Colorado. Nick, thank you very much for all this.
Thank you, Tom.
Kristen Duke at UC San Diego. Thanks for joining us, Kristen.
Thank you.
And Antonio Regalado at the MIT Technology Review. You're terrific. Come back soon. Thank you, Antonio.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for sticking around for this preview from Only a Game special report, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, available this weekend on your NPR station or podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. This week on WBUR and NPR's Only a Game, we dedicate the entire hour to one question. Should college athletes be paid?
Maybe you've heard. Big-time college sports are in trouble.
Well, it's about as bad as it gets. It's not the NCAA knocking on the door, but the FBI.
The FBI is charging 10 people with fraud and corruption.
We all know this system is corrupt. Every one of us knows it.
If there's going to be a death penalty, it needs to be to amateurism. Give amateurism the death penalty, then you have a chance at creating a system free of a lot of this corruption.
But the problems with the NCAA didn't begin on September 26th when those charges were announced.
The story of the NCAA is a story of power, money, and corruption. It's been going on for a long time, and it's the athletes and their families who get hurt.
I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming that I walk in the door and he's hanging. Or he shot himself because he's that depressed. You put trust in these universities. You trust them with your kid on and off the court. And once you're damaged good, they just kick you to the curb.
We've spent the past few months trying to figure out how the NCAA and amateurism went wrong. And can the system be fixed, or does it need to be dismantled?
Why in the world would we have football be a part of a college? What does that have to do with education?
Litigation hasn't worked. Organization hasn't worked. Legislation, there's no way it's going to work. So the only thing that was really left was competition.
I think we are in the midst of the tipping point. The question is, how far will it tip?